Next case is 97-1778, State of Ohio versus Johnny D. Rush.
Several sections. hundreds of sections which use the phrase notwithstanding section. None of those that I've been subject to this constitution is true. It's also those rules of construction codify what has been common law from this court. And the case that I find particularly insightful is the Lane versus McBride case, that Civil War voting case from 1863, which allowed the Civil War soldiers who were serving in the Union Army out of state to vote. And that was a specific exemption of the general, which required you to go to vote in your home township. Also, I think allowing the exemption requirement is within the spirit of Article 2, Section 15D, which is the Constitution claim in this case. Particularly in the Grubbs case, which is also out of Hamilton County, which it follows the Toler decision, which is a minority. But the Grubbs decision takes issue with it. It notes that the purpose of Article 2, Section 15D is to prevent cumbersome law that you kind of repealing things and adding, not striking out words, just adding new sections into the code. I mean, you can imagine at the time 15, D was put into place, just adding new laws at the end of the code book, which refer to previous laws when those laws haven't been taken off the books. Also, notably, in the idea of amendments under the term, under the revised code department, the constitutional provision, Section 15D, the term amendment, when it has been used in context with this restated full provision of Article 215D, has been a narrow definition of term amendment, and it includes the word change or strike out. Note that Senate Bill 2 was modified by Senate Bill 269 by incorporating nevertheless, despite it, it doesn't change, strike out, or alter. It still exists, it's still in the books, it's there for the benefit of criminal defendants when the law, when an offense is changed. Again, should the legislature not choose to exercise its power to exempt that provision? Finally, there's a misunderstanding, I believe, percolating up through the courts about the effect of 1.58B, and that is specifically in a Rush decision and others. The court held that it allows for an election by the chair. That's not the way the statute reads. In fact, it's mandatory that the trial court, when 1.58B comes into play, which we argue is not in this case, but it, that it shall impose the reduced penalty. In this case, the two sentencing schemes are not amenable to concise comparison. The old sentencing scheme allows for indeterminate time, but it also allows for reduction in sentence, for good time served in prison. The new sentencing scheme, of course, was enacted to provide indeterminate time. Sentence for 3 years, you will serve misbehaving in jail. Your term can be added up to a year and a half, 50% more of it. So it's very, very difficult for a trial court to even determine whether there's been a reduction, which then leads back to, do we even get to the constitutional question? Because if 1.58B doesn't apply, there's no reduction. But we can't even tell if there's a reduction. Then we don't even get to the constitutional question. Subject to any questions, I would deserve the rest of the
time. Let me ask you a question. I didn't see this in the briefs, but if 1.58 is a general statute, and Senate Bill 2, as I understand, Section 5 of Senate Bill 2 is more specific, why isn't Section 5 alone? It says the same thing as 269 does, minus the notwithstanding language.
Correct. I think that it just is, for the sake of clarity, I think the legislature's intent to really hammer the point home
understand that, but you haven't, I guess I wonder why you wouldn't argue, and I'll ask Ms. Stone that, why you should not have argued, why that section alone is just section five, and it's a statement by the General Assembly. We intend for this legislation to have a certain effect. And that's a more specific statement by the legislature than 1.58, which I think we all agree is a general statute of construction that can be overridden by a more specific statement. But
well, first of all, I think it's a stronger argument, obviously, the legislature chose to try to come with 269, but also there could be some ambiguity there because you were saying when the law, when the new offense is going to affect. But 1.58 seems to suggest that regardless of when the offense is going to affect, if the sentence changes between the indictment and the sentence, it makes sense to him. It makes sense. But again, it begs the question whether it has to.
On page 18 of your brief, you say the court then reasons Senate Bill 269 does not comport with 15D Article 2, and then this, but failed to explain how the complete exception of RC 158 by 269 modifies or amends 158B. I thought that's exactly what Judge Gwynne did in explaining why he thought 158 didn't apply, or did apply.
But it's just, if you look at the opinion, it's kind of clear from the opinion that he says that there's an ambiguity that exists and that for some reason, but because the criminal defendants are entitled to have ambiguities in favor, therefore the sentence is being blocked.
He says, we find neither Senate Bill 2 or 269 repeals the statutory provisions contained in 158. We further find there's a conflict between the statutory provisions and Senate Bill 2, creating an ambiguity in the law. Doesn't he say why that they hold the way they do? I thought he really did. And the three judges all concurred in that. Just one further question before you sit down. Let's take 158 out of the mixture altogether. Why shouldn't the law in effect at the time of sentencing be the law that a defendant is sentenced under? Because the statute says no?
No, the plenary power, I mean, it roots back to the inherent power of the legislature, the plenary power to prescribe crimes and punishment and to determine what date those punishments go into effect, as long as it does so within the bounds of the state federal constitution.
I don't think I tracked that. What is your reason for not applying the law in effect at the time of the sentencing? I mean, your argument is that it's got to be the law in effect at the time of the crime.
Correct.
Okay. So you'd say that as a general proposition for insurance contracts. Whatever the law was when the contract was drawn, that's when it ought to be in effect.
No, I would say that as a general proposition when the legislature specifically delineates for you.
Okay. So it's because the legislature said Senate Bill 2 should be, in Senate Bill 2, that at the time of the crime is the operative time.
Correct. Would that confirm the constitutionality of Senate Bill 2 as amended by Senate Bill 269? Reverse in those cases where the lower courts have not so held, and affirm in those cases where the lower courts have held the contrary. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. Ms. Stone.
Propositions set forth that Section 3 of Senate Bill 269 unconstitutionally amends Section 1.58B. The General Assembly's failure to follow the dictates of Article 2, Section 15D, when it enacted Section 3 to fail in its operation.
And why isn't the General Assembly in Senate Bill 269 just doing what it has done many times before and saying, in essence, we recognize that 1.58 is a general rule of construction, but we have the authority to make a more specific statement with regard to our intention on SB 2. And why can't the General Assembly do that without amending or negating or anything else? When all they're saying is that 158 stands for what it is, but in this section, we're making a more specific statement. That's not amending 158, is it? The word notwithstanding, does that mean amend? Does that mean we recognize 1.58, but it's disregarded for this purpose, in this
Chief Justice, this court in State Central Board of Education versus set out what is an amendment. And this discussion was also had in Clinton versus McBride. The test of whether or not an act is an amendment is a two-part test. The question is whether the act is intended to supersede or take the place of any former enactment, and whether the subject of the enactment was embraced by prior statutes. Section 3 of Senate Bill 269 speaks to the exact same subject matter as Section 1.58B. It is also intended to supersede 1.58B, hence it's an amendment. Now the General Assembly arguably has the plenary power to make these changes, but if it is going to make these changes, it must do so in conformity with Article 2, Section 15D, and this court has so held in State Ex-Rel Doctrine versus O'Brien. Had the court properly amended Section 1.58B, then the question before this court will be whether or not it is retroactive or ex post facto. So but the first question is whether or not Article 2, Section 15D, sets out a procedural limitation on the power of the General Assembly to enact a law. And it is Mr. Rush's proposition, and also this court's prior pronouncement, that it is an express limitation and it's mandatory.
So if we were to adopt that view, would that, I'm trying to see what the implication of that would be to other matters. The General Assembly then each time it wanted to avoid the effect of 1.58 would amend, I'm not sure how, so if it were to amend it in this instance, what would that mean for, it's a rule of construction, and so I guess I'm trying to figure out how it would apply to future cases.
1.58B in many ways is more than a rule of statutory construction. It is Mr. Rush's proposition that it confers a specific benefit upon him. However, despite that fact, if the General Assembly wanted to amend 1.58B, it needed to reproduce 1.58B in Senate Bill 2 or Senate Bill 269 and explain or set out exactly how it intended to amend that section. We have numerous published laws in our state that set out those changes, that have time limits and other things within the statute itself. So 1.58B would have been a part of Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 269. Not a simple reference in temporary language in Section 3 and in Section 5 of their respective bills. As I had indicated through the questions of the Chief Justice, it's Mr. Rush's proposition that Article 2, Section 15D is mandatory. Three cases of the Ohio Supreme Court support Mr. Rush's proposition that number one, Section 3 of Senate Bill 269 amends 1.58B, and number two, that Section 15, Article 2, is an express limitation on the power of the General Assembly to to enact this provision. First, in State Central Board of Education versus City School District versus Ox, this court defined amendment as any change by whatever name is an amendment. Now, the state, throughout its briefing and its argument, criticizes Mr. Rush for failing to include in the definition of notwithstanding. Without question, the definition of notwithstanding could be rephrased by Mr. Rush as posited in the state's brief. It doesn't change the ultimate conclusion that Section 3 of Senate Bill 269 amends 1.58B. Lehman versus McBride set out the test for what is an amendment. First, as I noted earlier, whether the act is intended to supersede or take the place of any former enactment, and two, whether the subject of the enactment was embraced by prior statutes. Clearly, that is the intent of Section 3 of 1.58B. There's no question about it. Hence, it's an amendment. Once that decision has been made that Section 3 is an amendment, then you turn to Article 2, Section 15D. This section has been declared to be mandatory, first in the discussions of Lehman versus McBride, and subsequent to that in State X. Roe Doc 3 versus O'Brien. This is an important.
I don't understand how the, like, even if we accept your argument as an amendment rather than an exception, the bill should contain more than one subject. That's what you're referring to, correct?
Section 15D has numerous clauses within its provisions. The one subject rule is one part of that. But the following language in Section 15D is what would control this argument. And that is,
you're basically saying that they would have to take 1.58B, put it in Senate Bill 2, retype the whole thing, resurrect it somehow.
That's what you have to do.
Just like all the other myriad statutes that are in Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 269, Section 1.58B, or Section 1.58 would appear in the statute. And when it's in that statute, there would be a subdivision C or language within B itself that indicated that Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 269 do not apply to that Section 1.58B does not apply to the imposition of punishment pursuant to Senate Bill 2 and Senate Bill 269.
Isn't that exactly what they did?
Justice Stratton, it's more than a semantic difference, it's a substantial difference. When I pick up a code book to determine what statutes apply to a client or to any citizen, and if I go 1.58B, I note no change in the law. I do not see that 1.58B has been accepted by a subsequent act of the General Assembly. I have no idea what the impact of subsequent laws are on that law.
But you would never be 1.58 has no meaning to your client unless you're looking at another law to apply it to. In this case, you're looking at Senate Bill 2 and 269, and now that's really what we're trying to construe, aren't we? We're trying to interpret that statute. That's the heart of this case, not 1.58, but Senate Bill 2.
Unfortunately, Justice Cook, you cannot interpret Senate Bill 269 and Senate Bill 2 in isolation.
Well, the important thing is in that legislation, we have, wouldn't you agree, very plainly laid out intent by the General Assembly. And they so plain that they went back and said, and we really mean it. So now we go to, I mean, the effort here now is to go to 1.58, where you say there should be a reduction, of course, there's the argument that we don't even know if there's a reduction. But the important thing is that that is the statute that you seek to interpret on behalf of Mr. Rush and your other clients is Senate Bill 2. Isn't that right? That's the one that we're looking at. Is it ambiguous? Could you argue, counsel, that those statutes taken together, the original and the amendment, can you argue that they are in any way ambiguous in terms of what penalty should apply to any given defendant?
Certainly, Justice Cook, that was the exact argument that was made by the case in Delgado, versus Delgado. It was also made by the Toler Court. There are two statutes that speak to identical issues, and they do create an ambiguity in the law.
As between the two of them,
and 1.5 applies to every provision in the code. So to say that only
Well, it applies except for notwithstanding, which gets us back to your argument that it's amended. I would like to ask you, counsel, if this legislation amended 1.58, what does 1.58 now say?
It has been posited by the 8th District that 1.58 applies, which would then resurrect 1.58B, and then therefore,
let's go to the amendment.
Rush would be able to benefit from 1.58B.
The argument, the constitutional argument that it's been amended, that Senate Bill 2 and 269 amend 1.58B, what does it now say arguing that it has been amended rather than there's an exception. What does it say as amended?
1.58B, perhaps I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. Isn't the argument that it was amended, the problem with the whole, one of your propositions is that the General Assembly has unconstitutionally amended 1.58.
Correct.
What does it say? Now, that amendment, how has it changed since it's been amended?
1.58B continues in full force and effect, and that's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And because Section 3 and Section 5 of Senate Bill 269 and Senate Bill 2 improperly attempted to amend 1.58B, those provisions are established. So 1.58B would appear in the criminal code in the same way as it appeared 2 years ago. It would show no substantial change at all. And I hope I've answered your question. I'm not sure I
can. Walking through the amendments here. First, yes, Senate Bill 2.
Correct.
And it set what on to the subject of affected the application.
The language in Senate Bill 2 was virtually identical to the language in Senate Bill 269.
So it made no reference to the...
Made no reference to 1.58.
So now you have two statutes arguably in conflict. That's right.
Addressing the identical.
Legislature figures that out, but that's potentially a problem.
I assume they figured that out.
Okay. Somebody decides to do 269 to address the problem. And if I understand your argument, then the constitutional flaw in 269, we come back to 2. The constitutional flaw in 269 is that it does not set forth in small type the full text of 158, is that correct?
Correct.
So that what it does is just this cross-referencing thing instead of bringing up, your argument is that the Constitution requires that you set forth the entire text of 158 if 158 is what you propose to amend.
Correct.
Correct. And then you would put in large type the amendments.
Correct.
And leaving the small type, the existing law that is on.
Correct. except for one part of your hypothetical, which is that there's not a cross-reference. 1.58 feet is not a cross-reference. Sections 2.
Okay, but what is the constitutional flaw?
A constitutional flaw is the failure to reproduce 1.58 feet.
The text of 1.58 feet.
And to note the amendment to it, to note how it changed. That's the flaw.
So there's no 1.58 feet in small type at all in 269?
Correct.
If that is what you say, that's the constitutional violation.
That is a procedural limitation on the power of the General Assembly to
amend the law. And every bill that's enacted is done in that fashion, the whole text. Are you not arguing that all of 2 had to be reproduced in 269?
The General Assembly had never spoken. And speaking in that area is in conflict with the Constitution in any way, and the court strongly affirmed their ability to do that. In similar fashion, the General Assembly is free to enact in laws as they see fit. However, when they are amending a law such as they did 1.58B, the limitations of Article 2, Section 15D must be complied with. And as noted in my brief, Article 2, Section 15D serves important public policy functions. It makes laws intelligible. It makes sure that legislation is not improvidently enacted. After all, 1.58B has been the law of the state for over 26 years, and it provides notice to all of us that there's been a change.
Your red light's on. You need to end your argument.
Thank you. As noted, Ohio's Constitution is the highest law of the state, and it represents our social compact. The General Assembly has broad plenary powers to enact laws, and Mr. Marsh does not agree with that. But Article 2, Section 15D, is an expressive limitation on the power of the General Assembly. A procedural limitation on the power of the General Assembly to enact laws.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor. Judge Kerfus says that you can't, General Assembly can't do what it did here. You cannot change a substantive law with a permanent law, which 158 is, with a temporary law. What's your response to that? You've been a response in one of the briefs, but I would like to hear you.
Well, I think there's a couple of things bound up in what Judge Kerfus is saying. Number one, the question of whether or not law must be codified.
Trying to play out the procedure for enacting legislation. There are no rules for special exceptions, I take it.
Not in this provision, no.
Do you have to have rehearings for special exceptions?
Excuse me, Your Honor.
Well, special exceptions, that's a new category of legislation. Do they have to have rehearings?
I believe it's not on the category of bylaw recognizes this as the case law of this court for many years recognized that when you pass a specific provision which conflicts with a previously enacted general provision, the specific provision will control when the two are irreconcilable. And as that the special provision prevails as an exception in the bylaw.
So you have this category of legislation that you would call not amendments, not revisions, but special exceptions. That's what 269 is. It's a piece of legislation we're going to call a special exception. Now, I'm not trying to read down the premise back with you. Is that what I understand your distinction to be? This is a different category. Not amendments, not revisions, it's a special exception.
Well, I guess the bottom line is I do call it a special exception.
So
I sure
are there no constitutional guidelines for the General Assembly enacting special exceptions? You run up the flag, you found the gavel, and today's first order of business is special exceptions. Here it is. Well,
insofar as this provision is concerned, where you have to publish in full the exception as amended, that this constitutional provision does not apply because it's not amended. I'm not.
But did 269 get three hearings and it was very popular?
I assume it did. I'm not researched that issue.
The exception is not applied to the provision.
Yes. In my view, and I think this is supported by the Lehman versus McCarty case, the Lehman case talks about what this provision of our Constitution is driving at, which is they don't want things to be done the way Congress does it, which is when Congress passes the law, it'll say in line 6, certain words are chosen on line 7, these words are added. And the congressman or the legislator doesn't see the final version of the statutory section in its final form as amended. And I think that's what Lehman says, you know, this constitutional provision is right. And you look at that purpose behind this constitutional provision, you see that it was not violated here. No words were added or stricken from what would be. This separate statutory provision was enacted into law as an original enactment. And anyone looking at Section 5 of Central 10 and Section 3 of 269, they don't need to look at 1.58B to see what these sections say. It's clear that 1.58B does not apply, it's irrelevant, and that the rule for Central 2 sentencing law changes is addressed in this section and no other. And so no change was affected in 1.58B. In addition, I would...
So where would you find this in the books? When you represent the defendant, where do you go to this provision?
You look to the laws of Ohio, the session laws, to see where this is published, and it is published in the laws of Ohio.
So you can't pull down pages or volumes or go to your computer and pull it out. You've got to go and track down what day this passed to the General Assembly and what the General passed and so on.
Well, I do recall seeing this somewhere in the revised code. It's not, I checked this morning, it's not published in pages after 1.5A, but that's one of
the things. Isn't that part of the problem? Isn't that the reason for the constitutional provisions? It's for an enactment of the General Assembly for people to avail themselves of it. There's got to be some place which go to work.
But that, I, revised code is a convenient method of finding law, but it is not the end all of the law. Laws of Ohio, the session laws, are the laws. And whether or not it ends up becoming part of the revised code is basically a ministerial matter. This court in the standard surety case talked about, back then, the Attorney General was numbering statutes, and the Attorney General would assign certain numbers. And this court said that was not significant, what numbers the Attorney General had assigned to the section, because this is not part of the power to legislate. And I think that's a telling indicator that this, there is no requirement of codification. In fact, this has been this ministerial task, and it has been assigned to the Director of the Legislative Service Commission on April 1. I think that's a clear indication that it's not an absolute necessity for something to become a law under the Ohio Constitution that it had a section number in the revised code. And so I don't think it's essential that someone be able to go to the revised code to find Section 5702. So long as it's part of the session laws, part of the bill passed by the General Assembly and blessed.
Mr. Taylor, your contention is that 158 was not amended, and therefore 15D doesn't apply. Do we know what the word revived means? It says that no law shall be revived or amended. What does revived mean? Sounds like we're going to pump life into something.
I think what revived means, let's say the General Assembly in the previous session had repealed the law, and in the current session it wants to reenact that law. What the Constitution provision is saying regarding reviving the law is that if you're going to revive that previously repealed law, you have to set it up in full. You can't just say the previous law of the Act of 1867 or whatever is hereby reenacted. You've got to publish it in full.
So in any event, whatever the wording revived means is not applicable to this situation. Amendment would be applicable, if any at all. And you say it's not. Okay, thanks.
Convince me that your client would be better off under Senate Bill 2 sentencing than under pre-Senate Bill 2 sentencing. He got 5 to 25, concurrent terms of 5 to 25 years, and with the usual parole for activity, he'd serve about 2/3 of that. Is that?
Chief Justice, my client is Mr. Rush, and he's bargained to discuss.
I thought you were going to be speaking for Mr. Mitchell.
I will be speaking on behalf of Mr. Mitchell as well.
You're on rebuttal. You're speaking for Mr. Mitchell on rebuttal, my understanding.
Okay. I understand.
That's why I asked the question, because I thought he's the reverse, and he's been convicted and sentenced to, I understand it, maybe I'm wrong, 5 to 25 year concurrent sentence. I guess what I'm getting at is, how can you be sure with the fact that Senate Bill 2 attempted to make this so-called neutral conversion from the old sentencing scheme where people served about 2/3 of their sentence to a fixed sentence, a so-called truth in sentencing, where when they get a sentence, that's it. How can you be sure that that Mr. Mitchell would do better?
Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Mitchell advised of the ramifications of Senate Bill 2, which used to be sentenced under it. Under Senate Bill 2, his sentence would most likely max out at 10 years. Under the old law, the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction can hold him for 25 years. But most importantly, Mr. Mitchell, who's going to serve the pains of the punishment, should be the person to decide which statute is in his benefit. And being advised of the distinctions between the two statutes, he should, the election is one method to effectuate 1.58B.
The Court of Appeals, of course, gave the option to Mr. Rush, I guess, to choose. Where does that authority come from, that the defendant, the person who's convicted, has can choose the sentence that he or she is going to serve?
Chief Justice, the authority comes from past enactments of the General Assembly on how to deal with 1.58B and the ramifications of significant changes in the sentencing law. Election is one remedy that can be used to effectuate 1.58B. This court is free to fashion other remedies that would allow him to get the benefit of the reduced sentence.
Don't we have a legal issue here that we either decide that the General Assembly did it right or they did it wrong? And if they did it wrong, then he's sentenced under the new law. If they did it correctly, he's sentenced under the old law, isn't he? Why is there a choice? It seems to me it's a legal issue. We decide it one way or the other, and that's set for everybody.
The legal issue is, what is the ramifications of Senate Bill 2 and 269 versus the old sentencing law under 199,
right,
et cetera? What those sentencing provisions mean to each offender, and which sentence would most likely benefit the offender, which would allow him to get the benefit of 1.58B, can be best determined by the person who's going to be punished under those provisions. With notice from the court and the advice of counsel, the offender will certainly act in his best interest when deciding which sentence clearly gives him a benefit. So the election is a remedy that has been fashioned by the General Assembly, and under the prior law, where there were some changes in the law and 1.58B applied, that was also a remedy that was used to advise people and allow them the opportunity to choose which law to be sentenced under. Clearly, Mr. Mitchell would prefer to be sentenced under Senate Bill 2 versus the prior law, prior 199.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.